Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Hi, everyone. I'm Michelle Shapiro. I'm a partner in the White Collar and Government Investigations Group at Arendt Fox Schiff. I'm based in New York. I also have an office in New York where I worked for the first 21 years of my career. I've been in Boston for the last four. It's a pleasure to be joined by my co-panelists. I'll let everybody introduce themselves. I know from looking at the participants that mostly people are interested in hearing Seth Costo speak. So I'm going to turn it over to him first. No offense, Wells and Jasmine.
I hope they're not gravely disappointed. Michelle, thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Seth Costo. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the District of Massachusetts. I've been with the department as an AUSA since about 2005, first in lovely Newark, New Jersey. And since 2012 here, I'm a deputy chief in the securities, financial, and cyber fraud unit, which is one of our main white collar units here in the Boston office. And it's a pleasure to be part of the panel today. Thanks. And maybe I'll toss it over to Wells.
I was just trying to find my own mute button. Thanks, Seth. So I'm Wells Miller. I'm a member of the tax group here at Aiken in our Boston office. Focused on executive compensation, and I've been focused on that area for about the past 13 years now, 14 years. So I'm here less on sort of the white collar side of it and more on the plan design, implementation, things to think about sort of at the outset while we're thinking about clawbacks and how to implement this guidance. Jasmine?
Awesome. Thanks, Wells. Good afternoon, everyone. Happy to be here. My name is Jasmine Tess, and I am a global investigator in the Global Ethics and Compliance Group at Takeda. Prior to joining Takeda, I was at Choate Hall and Stewart in their Government Enforcement and Investigations Group for 5 years. And so I'm joining more on the white collar side. Happy to be here with you all and looking forward to the conversation.
One more question.
Yeah, it keeps me. I didn't mute myself. All right, we're going to be wary of that mute button. Jasmine, do you want to start us off by giving just a brief summary overview of what the DOJ pilot program entails? We're just past the 1 year mark, and so before we delve into what it's been looking like for the past year and some tips, let's just start by a baseline understanding.
Yeah, great. So as many of you may know, in March 2023, DOJ announced a 3-year pilot program for companies entering criminal resolutions. And the program is largely aimed at encouraging companies to implement compensation systems that use affirmative metrics and benchmarks to reward compliance-promoting behavior, and then also to impose financial penalties that can deter risky behavior. So the two main components of the program, I'll go through them at a high level. So the first component is what they're calling compliance enhancements. So during the duration of the pilot program, every corporate resolution will have a requirement that the company implement some criteria related to compliance in its compensation and bonus system. So some affirmative, quantifiable requirement in compensation and bonus programs that can incentivize compliant behavior among employees. And we'll talk a little bit later about what these can look like, what some of the suggestions from the DOJ are. And then the second component of the program is what they're calling deferred fine reduction. So if a company has entered a criminal resolution and they've cooperated and they've remediated to the prosecution's satisfaction and they've instituted a program to claw back compensation for wrongdoers, then the company will be required to pay the original fine as is typical, but that amount will be discounted by the amount of compensation the company is attempting to claw back. So they're calling this the possible clawback reduction. And then there could possibly be an additional fine reduction when the company has in good faith attempted to initiate the process to recoup compensation before the time of resolution. So there's a credit for the attempt and then a fine reduction for the amount recouped. And so that covers the two general components. One thing I thought was notable about the program as well as a whole was when referring to culpable employees, this extends to those who had supervisory authority over the employee or business area engaged in the misconduct and those who knew of and were willfully blind to the misconduct. So just an interesting note there. But those are the two main components of the program and a brief overview.
Thanks, Jasmine. When this was announced last March, I think a lot of firms issued client alerts talking about how this was a, sort of a major change in DOJ policy. And I'm not sure if they got it quite right, but want to turn it over to Seth to comment on that and just add his perspective as being someone working with this policy for the last year.
And so the white-collar practitioners among you will know that it's a bit of a depressing reality that if you are in Parts one and two of this pilot program, a lot of bad things have already happened at your organization. Companies are criminally liable for the conduct of their employees just on sort of a straight respondeat superior basis. And that can happen as long as the companies think they're benefiting the company in some way. And that can be even if the employees are violating express company policy in undertaking whatever criminal conduct they go after. So what the department has done here, or the criminal division and nationally, is to sort of put some flesh on the bones of things that already exist in our determinations of what to do with a company that is criminally liable by virtue of what its employees have done, or if we're investigating that, what the company's exposure is. And so it's important to keep in mind that this program is kind of an extension of the principles of federal prosecution of business organizations. There's a lengthy list of the kind of things we take into account in evaluating whether to charge a company and what to charge a company with. It's in something called the Justice Manual at Chapter 9-28. It used to be the U.S. Attorney's Manual. Now we're, I guess, appealing to a broader audience. We're calling it the Justice Manual. But so in those principles, how we make our decisions, we're already looking at compliance programs as they existed at the time the employees engaged in the criminal conduct. And then we're also looking at the company's remedial measures among a wide variety of other factors: how serious the conduct is, how were the victims affected, how deep into the company did it go, was the C-suite involved, what kind of the remedial measures, what kind of collateral consequences might there be in like an Arthur Andersen type situation if the company's charged. So there's a big menu of items. This policy, this pilot program, fits into the company's remedial actions. So if the pilot program is about requiring, as part of corporate resolution, these kind of improvements, one of the things I'll be encouraging you to think about is sort of pushing those considerations forward. So you're not offering them to the department as part of a pilot program, but instead having them evaluated by me and my colleagues at a time when there's still something you can do for your company vis-a-vis being charged or how one is charged.
Thanks, Seth. I think it's interesting to note too that under the Justice Manual, Principles of Federal Prosecution of Business Organizations, the DOJ talks about the need to hold companies accountable for the wrongdoing of their people. But that also, the force behind much of it is change. I'm going to quote the manual: force for positive change of corporate culture. The government wants to be a force for change of corporate culture. So I think that your point, right, that DOJ is really hoping that companies will get out ahead of this is spot on. And though all of us in the white collar defense field sort of earn much of our compensation based on helping companies that are in trouble already. And we're going to talk more about this as our program continues, but it's a heck of a lot cheaper to do it beforehand and maybe avoiding the problem altogether. And so that's, I think, really what DOJ is trying to incentivize with this program. There's a clawback program or policy that the SEC adopted not too long ago that Wells is going to talk to us about.
Right. Yeah. Thanks, Michelle. We just at the outset, we wanted to distinguish this DOJ pilot program that we're talking about from the clawback guidance that the SEC promulgated at actually about the same time last year. They're finally implementing some rules required by Dodd-Frank. It took about 8 years to get there. And it appears the timing is just a coincidence, but since we've been waiting quite a bit anyway. But those rules, those SEC rules, are rules for stock exchanges, requiring stock exchanges to implement requirements that listed companies adopt a clawback policy related to financial restatements. And those rules are completely distinct from these rules, and they differ in kind of two important ways. One, the SEC rules only apply to publicly traded companies. DOJ rules apply to everybody. And the SEC rules only apply in cases of a financial restatement. And what the SEC rules are targeted at is what they call improperly awarded compensation. So compensation that someone received as a result of an overly optimistic, we'll call it, financial statement that later had to be restated. So, you know, we thought revenue was X, it was actually a little bit lower. The higher revenue resulted in payout of larger bonuses. Now we need to claw that back. It's completely no fault. The individuals who are getting the money clawed back may have had absolutely nothing to do with the behavior that resulted in the restatement. And it's just the idea is that the government believes that the shareholders shouldn't bear the cost of that. The management shouldn't benefit from these incorrect financial statements that later had to be adjusted down. And that we saw a fair amount of confusion just because of the timing and the fact that, you know, clawbacks are not, it's not something that at least our clients sort of think about every day. Because we had these two different pieces of guidance come out at the same time, we found that there was some confusion. We had clients saying, oh, I didn't think this clawback stuff applied to us. We're not publicly traded. Or, oh, we already have sort of a general clawback policy. We think it satisfies the SEC's requirements. And there was some education that had to happen to sort of explain to folks, hey, no, actually, this is totally different. And this is something you should think about very particularly and could affect your organization in very different ways than this, as these SEC clawback policies, which are, I don't want to say they're vanilla, but they're a little more straightforward and a little simpler to implement. And we found the clients struggled with them a lot less than the clients who really wanted to dig in on the DOJ guidance and think about it hard and figure out how it would affect their organization.
The DOJ pilot program applies to a much broader swath of corporate America. In fact, it applies to all companies, not just in America, where there's jurisdiction here, that's enough. And, you know, so we think about what are the kinds of companies that typically find themselves embroiled in some government investigation. And the common ones that come to mind, of course, are, you know, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, or, you know, we're here in Boston, there's a lot of activity around the anti-kickback statute and False Claims Act generally for government contractors. But, you know, it's also domestic bribery and criminal antitrust violations and environmental law violations, just good old generic, you know, wire fraud and mail fraud. So it's really any company can see itself in an investigation, which means, therefore, that this policy could become relevant to them. The two instances that we've seen so far that I'm aware of, I think I speak for my co-panelists too, saying this is what we know of, are a settlement with SAP, the global software company, and a settlement with Albemarle, a global chemicals company. Those were both resolutions of FCPA investigations by the DOJ and SEC. SAP wound up paying over $220 million for their resolution. $118 million of it were for the criminal penalty. And the press release issued by DOJ specifically notes that penalty was reduced by about $109,000 for compensation that SAP withheld from qualifying employees, which action the company defended in substantial litigation. So I think there are two interesting things in those word choices. One, it's that compensation that SEP withheld from. So it's not, we're talking about clawbacks, but it looks like DOJ is also giving credit for just withholding the money in the first place. So if you're embroiled in an investigation, while there's a decision that has to be made, for example, about a discretionary bonus, and you decide as a company, your company decides not to pay that bonus to individuals that are suspected of being involved in the underlying conduct, and you withhold their bonus, that could be sort of credited under this part two of the DOJ pilot program. And the other thing in the SEP press release that I thought was interesting, the language that says, which the company defended in substantial litigation. I don't know, it doesn't say the word successfully defended. And so even though the pilot program, I think, really speaks, it makes it sound like you have to actually ultimately make good on the clawback. This is at the inception, right? So these cases, these if there's some employment litigation or dispute over the clawback, that could take years and years to unfold. But at the time of the resolution, it seems that what DOJ is looking for is a commitment by the company to defend its position, and that was noted there. Albemarle has similar language in their press release. About part two. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, I just wanted to go back to SAP for a second and mention that the press release also talks about part one, that under the resolution, the company was committed to implementing criteria related to compliance in their compensation and bonus system, which is something that we've been seeing in these corporate resolutions, frankly, for a really long time. And then in Albemarle, they talk about part two. So the company overall paid about a little bit over $218 million to resolve those investigations by the SEC and DOJ. $98 million was for a criminal penalty, which, according to the DOJ's press release, reflects a reduction of $763,000+ for bonuses that the company withheld from qualifying employees. So two examples so far.
Yeah, what's interesting about those numbers, if you think about it, is it can't be about the money. If we're talking seven-, eight-figure, $97, $98 million criminal penalties to pull back $100,000, $109,000 in clawed back comp or the bonuses for 16 employees, this is messaging and getting back to the idea of fixing and pre-remediating executive comp. It's striking, those numbers.
Yeah, it seems apparent that it would cost more to litigate if there was a dispute over with the individual about the clawback or withholding of their compensation than they're actually getting a pure like dollar for dollar benefit under the program. But I would venture a guess that if you were to talk to the defense lawyers and in-house lawyers involved in those cases, they believe that it resulted in some more amorphous reduction in the overall penalty or just how the cases were resolved helped portray to the government that these companies really were embracing a culture of compliance and taking it seriously and trying to hold individuals accountable. That's more important perhaps than the dollar for dollar.
And to your point, Michelle, I think we have seen, I'd say in the past 12 to 24 months, I don't think it's because of this pilot program per se, but there are a lot of programs out there encouraging voluntary self-disclosure. We have seen a marked rise in voluntary self-disclosures and referrals that we're not getting from the companies in the FCPA area in particular. So maybe if you're on this webinar and you're an exec comp lawyer who represents clients, the question you should be asking yourself is, you know, do we do business and do we pay our execs? Are we a pharma company, or could we potentially have involvement with the SEC in a case? I came through our office came through a case fairly recently that was somewhat atypical in its fact pattern, but presented an issue of corporate liability and the involvement of senior executives. And what was striking to me was how much of a hot button executive comp is in these prosecutions. Our case involved, let's say for purposes of this discussion, an executive who left the company within days of the stuff hitting the fan, who walked away with between 42 and 59 million or 57 million in contractually required severance payments. And the pilot policy here talks about employees who are criminally culpable or employees who supervise and are willfully blind to. And assume for the purposes of this discussion that that executive who left was not willfully blind to or did not participate in the criminal conduct. It was still a big issue in the decision about the company's ultimate entrance into a deferred prosecution agreement, because one of the things we had to look at was the adequacy and effectiveness of the corporation's compliance programs at the time of the offense. And here you had a CEO who was headed out the door in the wake of a large corporate criminal event. And it just didn't sit well with decision makers in my office. And I think in the sort of gestalt feel about how the company comes out in that case.
Great. So just to like underscore that point, the executive may not have been involved in the wrongdoing, may not have been willfully blind, but if the facts and circumstances sort of give the government some pause that there's a cultural, fundamental cultural problem at the company, and that especially with senior executives, the fact that they're maybe even unaware that it's happening, fair to say, Seth, that the government wonders, like, well, why were you not aware what was going on? Is it enough just to be the standard for legal culpability to be willful blindness? It looks like you're kind of raising your expectations.
Yeah, this goes beyond the pilot program, but if the answer is we had to pay it, the contract required it, or this wasn't a for-cause termination, just speaking generally, not about that particular case. If it's not a for-cause termination, the money goes. The question that remains is the one addressed by this pilot program. What does that say about the culture of compliance at the company that someone could be presiding over an organization at which significant criminal conduct took place that pervaded deeply into the C-suite and still receive the benefit of, an A-plus performance?
Yeah, that's a really good segue into why we invited Wells to participate in this, right? We've been focused a lot on the white collar implications, but really, if we're thinking about what do companies do to get ahead of this and to set up things in a way that DOJ will find acceptable or better than acceptable, Wells, what should and could companies be doing from a labor and employment perspective?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Just stepping back a little bit, I see we have a lot of our participants on the call today are white collar practitioners. And as I assume, I've been at a few different firms in my practice area, and I assume that that my experience is common among most firms where the folks who are focusing on white collar, they sit in the litigation group, they do their thing, they advise their clients. And sometimes there might be some overlap with the executive compensation practitioners or the corporate practitioners, probably more likely. But often those two groups don't necessarily coordinate. And I know from some of my own personal efforts within Aiken and just from talking to other executive compensation practitioners, I don't think that knowledge of this DOJ pilot program is necessarily widespread among the folks who are helping clients design these plans. And I think that the white collar practitioners could bring a lot of benefit to them. So question, what do you do now? What do you do at the outset? These plans are revisited annually. Often every time an employment agreement is entered into, people are thinking hard about the definition of cause, and they're thinking hard about the annual bonus program, and they're thinking about what these folks are entitled to and the situations in which they're entitled to severance. Those conversations, I can tell you, don't typically include conversations with the client about compliance and certainly not about this DOJ pilot program. And I think they should. I think that, and I think it's for all clients, as Seth and Michelle have pointed out, but particularly in certain industries, it really should be at the forefront. And the clients, their standard definition of cause, for example, in their employment agreements, would significantly benefit from the input of a practitioner who works across from DOJ and who thinks about these issues and has helped a client work through one of these unpleasant situations. Because I can tell you that a typical standard definition of cause, it's not just the company that Seth was referring to, where CEO walks out the door with a significant amount of comp. It's not a termination for cause. There's nothing anyone can do. A typical definition of cause wouldn't pick that up. Did this individual do something wrong? Did they themselves commit a felony, or they've been convicted of a felony? Is it their personal actions that resulted in this? And if it wasn't, if it was a subordinate, not even a direct report, someone way down the line, typically you wouldn't be able to terminate them without paying severance, absent some specific language, someone bringing it to the attention of the exec comp lawyers, the corporate lawyers, the employment lawyers who are negotiating these agreements at the outset. And I think that in a lot of cases, it would cost very little. These definitions of cause get revisited in practically every time you negotiate an employment agreement for any high-ranking exec. And nobody ever thinks, well, I'm the one who, we don't get any pushback on the you can't commit a felony or that's cause clause, right? Like, nobody's like, well, actually, that's kind of a big deal for me. I need to be able to commit felonies. Like, that doesn't happen, right? So similarly, if you're negotiating this at the outset and you're including provisions that say, look, at this organization and for this client, compliance is really front of mind. And so we have a clause in our cause definition that captures that. And so, if we have one of these events, and it would vary by executive, but if we have one of these events and it happens among certainly one of your direct reports or maybe within your group, then that can constitute cause, and that can result in a termination without severance. That's going to be a lot less contentious 3 years before the event happens, rather than as you're negotiating with the exec who feels totally maligned. I couldn't possibly have done anything. This was totally outside my control, and is fighting to keep comp that has a real dollar amount attached to it, and they're expecting. And so that's one piece, designing the definitions of cause, in your broader base incentive plan, thinking about metrics, thinking about language. At the outset, when we were prepping for this, I was thinking about what organizations have very publicly gone through, had very public compliance problems. So of course, not just because of my first name, I thought of Wells Fargo. And so I pulled their incentive plan, and you won't be surprised to hear they've got an entire separate paragraph. Well, an entire separate section, three paragraphs. In order to even be eligible for this plan, you can't have ever done anything wrong in your entire life. You can never have thought of anything, doing anything wrong, right? Like, it lays all that out. And so that gives you something to point to if, rather than in a clawback scenario, but if you're trying to hold back compensation that would otherwise be owed, that's something to point to say, look, because of this internal investigation around your behavior in connection with this compliance problem, you're actually not even eligible for a bonus this year until we clear that. Most plans don't have, it might be surprising, but most plans don't have language like that. On the clawback side, on the clawing back of compensation previously paid, it also might be surprising to participants on this call to hear that clawbacks are not typically built into these employment agreements or into the plans. The best you kind of get is sometimes you get language that says that if the executive is terminated for cause, or circumstances existed at the time they were terminated that the company later learns would constitute cause, then severance isn't payable, and acceleration on equity and all that sort of stuff doesn't happen. That's kind of the best that you get. But again, your definition of cause probably isn't going to capture a lot of this behavior, and so that doesn't help. And a separate explicit language about clawing back compensation, again, separate from the kind of limited policies that you now see at public companies that are required at public companies, that's also not a typical provision in an executive employment agreement or an incentive plan. And so that's an area where folks on this call who practice in this area, if you have exec comp lawyers, labor and employment lawyers that you know are working on this kind of stuff for firm clients, you might approach them and say, hey, this has come out. It looks like the DOJ is really focused on this. This might be something we want to talk about and think through with clients. Maybe the client doesn't want to do anything, but always good to raise it.
Thanks, Wells. Jasmine, when you were doing an overview of the pilot program, you mentioned that there were a couple of specific examples that DOJ lists in part one about how to have a robust compliance program and incentivize compliance. Can you talk a little bit about those factors?
Yeah, sure. So we've talked a little bit about the first suggestion. So the first one is withholding bonuses from employees who don't satisfy compliance requirements. So doing that kind of proactively, having something in your contract that talks about withholding bonuses if you don't satisfy certain requirements. And the second one is disciplinary measures for employees who violate law and other employees, as we spoke about, supervisory authority over employee or business area that was engaged in the misconduct, and employees who were willfully blind. So what disciplinary measures do you have in place in the compensation structure for employees like that? And then compensation incentives for employees who demonstrate a full commitment to compliance processes. Are there incentives for folks that have demonstrated, you know, they've always been acting compliantly, their compliance metrics that the company uses to track these in order to compensate compliant behavior? So these are the suggestions that the DOJ has laid out. They aren't, they don't provide exact language to include in the employment contracts, but it seems like, as we've spoken about, the operative question is, how is the company structuring its existing compliance program such that there are some concrete rewards for compliant behavior and then punishments for non-compliant behavior?
Thanks. Seth, to add to that from your perspective, have you seen things work or not work in the past year plus in this realm?
Well, I guess the one main message would be in my vernacular, like be a seven or be a five, not a seven. Part five is of the principles of federal prosecution, the adequacy and effectiveness of the programs at the time of the offense versus what the company has done under part seven to remediate. I think optimistically, rather than being in clawback mode, I think what would be successful would be to point to aspects where people have earned promotions, where people have earned discretionary compensation by completing a component of their performance evaluation, and to have a track record of saying to the government, listen, it's not just the Wells Fargo language that Wells was describing, which can cost you dearly on the back end, but we are an organization that will include compliance in every performance review of every employee. So if it is, you're designing a performance review for a cashier at a big box store, there are five questions that are measured, you know, for that employee. Did you see something and say something? Did you, you know, make a point of showing up on working on time and working your full day's work for your full day's pay? And if you complete whatever small portion of that performance evaluation positively, it has a net bump for you. And being able to point to that historically and saying, this is what we have been doing. So clearly we think about and care about compliance. What's sometimes, you know, brings out the skeptic, and, you know, I'm a fundamentally optimistic person about people's willingness to do the right thing, is to hear about them in hindsight and say, look what we're doing. We are completely changing the tone of the ship here. We are, you know, recording videos. We have a new tone at the top. Better to have had the tone at the top before you're talking to us.
Good tips. How does DOJ really evaluate the compliance program, whether you're a five versus a seven? Can you talk a little bit about, like, what actually happens in the room when you guys are sitting down trying to decide, okay, we've gotten all these, you know, presentations by the defense counsel for the company, and we've interviewed witnesses, and now we're going to actually apply these 11 criteria under the principles. How do you go about, and this goes broader than the pilot program, but like, obviously DOJ has a lot of discretion to decide the outcome. So can you kind of give us a, you know, the room where it happened sort of conversation?
I guess it would be, for me at least, it's been the application of the facts to the black letter law on this point, right? The black letter law is the policy having an quote unquote adequate compliance program. I've seen that manifest itself very effectively where a corporation says, we had this many calls to our compliance hotline. We issued this many discretionary bonuses to employees who established a positive management tone. We issued, we referred for 360 evaluation a senior executive who had serious problems with the way in which they were communicating within the organization. So it's not simply that one has an employment hotline or that one has a Wells Fargo style metric in its employment contracts, but that when your lawyers are coming to the department, they can point to, it almost sounds anecdotal, but it's not, because it's statistically based and driven in the same way that, Abita is a great value of the measure of the value of the company and its shares. These kind of numbers can be a great measure of the value of a compliance program. So for me, when I have sat and listened to presentations, what's been effective is not the programs and structures in place, but how frequently those programs and structures are used and how successfully they are used.
I was once involved in an internal investigation that was prompted by some government questions, where we were interviewing employees at a factory about their knowledge of the whistleblower hotline, where the in-house lawyers and employment lawyers for the company were touting this fabulous line that they had. And employee after employee never heard of it, didn't know about it, but literally it was posted right there where we were doing the interviews. And so I understood the disconnect, because as the lawyers, the people sitting, in some cases, many, many miles away, literally, if not figuratively, they think, well, it is published, the number's out there. But that doesn't mean that the message is actually being delivered to the people who might utilize it. So looking at the metrics of how often calls are received and not just assuming, well, we've gotten no calls, so everything must be perfect. Right.
I think every business organization has an EEO bulletin board somewhere. Arts was in the kitchen on the ninth floor here, and the kitchen is no longer there, which, now I'm in the role of that employee who doesn't know where that bulletin board is. So I think, town halls and communications from the most senior executives tend to attract attention, right? If the CEO hosts a webinar and says, this is how we're going to do business, I'd watch that. Primetime viewing, primetime visits, primetime meetings with people who employees in a large organization would admire and respect. And that might not necessarily be their boss in every situation.
Wells or Jasmine, anything you want to add to that?
I would just say it's, we hear the adage with like shipping that it's the last mile that's the most expensive. You hear something similar with the employee communications. Like, you can roll out these policies, you can change the plans, you can do all of this stuff, but just posting a poster in the workroom, or the modern version, just including it in a company-wide email, I mean, we all know that those don't get read. I don't read them, right? Like, it's everybody's inbox is full. You have, depending on your organization, you may have a ton of people that don't even have much interaction with a company email address. And sort of thinking about the sort of cost benefit of these programs and what you're trying to accomplish, I think it's come up already a couple times in this program. If you're in clawback mode or you're in damage control mode, 90% of the costs are already baked in, right? Like, it's already too late. At the outset, really, actually, honestly, trying to drive compliance and bake that into all the programs, and then carefully communicating that to the employees from the highest level on down, is really important. And the situations that I've seen, the few where I've actually kind of gotten involved, usually for some advice on is there some way to avoid paying the severance or something like that? Those are all, every case I've been involved in, it hasn't actually been, I know certainly it happens, but it hasn't actually been like a CEO, CFO. It hasn't been a top level exec. It's been somebody a little bit more in the middle of the organization who has, you know, a few direct reports, you know, has, you know, is in charge of a chunk of P&L. Like they're an important person in the organization, but they're on nobody's list of the real drivers of the organization. And those folks don't get communicated with as carefully as a CEO, a CFO. You know, they aren't in the board meetings, they aren't hearing it. And so I think actually a lot of this is really, I don't know if this is a positive or a negative, but this is stuff that a lot of organizations I think are already doing. I mean, or at least thinking about a little bit, but focusing on the communication piece, I think could really pay dividends. And I think it's actually not super expensive. It's a little bit of a pain. It requires some time, but thoughtful employee communication can go a long way. And we see that just with incentive programs generally, keeping employee morale up, making people feel like, you know, they're being listened to and they're getting paid. And this is just one more area.
I think that you mentioned cost-benefit analysis. I think that with respect to part one of the pilot program, the cost-benefit analysis is, you know, pretty clear. Companies have been grappling with it for some time now. I think the challenge, though, in doing the cost-benefit analysis under part two is unique in that, you know, you're talking, again, part two is the clawback or potentially the back. So when a company is looking to resolve a DOJ investigation, they're looking for closure, right? Like above else, that's like one of the big goals is we want to just get on with business. But once you have instituted this decision to hold back or claw back, and let's say you terminate employees, well, now you're talking about potentially some protracted litigation where you're going to have to defend the decision under the policies. And Wells, you were talking about what the definition of cause is. Well, now you're in a situation where you're going to have to prove up why that employee was terminated for cause. Maybe DOJ, you know, has already indicted that person and things become a little bit easier. But to the extent you are looking for closure, that part two, I think, does kind of leave some, you know, dangling, hanging chads there for how this will all, you know, play out potentially, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road.
Yeah. And I mean, and that cost of litigation versus the amount you're actually going to claw back if you're unlikely to be successful regardless. That's probably a subject of an entire other VBA presentation about clawbacks and the tax implications and whether you can actually be successful in pulling it back, even if you have clear grounds under the contract. But just practically the amounts involved, okay, so we have exceptions. Maybe it's a CEO and it's $50 million of severance, but for the vast majority of employees, and hopefully you're in a situation where it's a very small group of employees that are actually responsible for the problematic behavior, it's the legal fees, unfortunately, are going to be significant because it's going to be real litigation and it's going to take a while. And the amounts involved are just not going to be large. It's not going to be the $50 million CEO. It's going to be $100,000, $200,000, $500,000 here or there. Even if you get it all back, a huge chunk of that's eaten up in legal fees. The amount of time and hassle and man hours required are going to be very difficult.
But I've had go ahead, Jasmine. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say one thing I was curious about reading the policy was looking at the attempts, the fine reduction, even if you're unsuccessful, right? How much of an attempt is a good enough attempt, right? If you have the language in your contracts, if you're going through this litigation, what does that look like? I don't know, Seth, if you had any thoughts on that, but that's something that came across my mind.
I was just going to say that I've had good lawyers say to me, we're going to get sued, but we're going to do this. And it's because the cost of any kind of good faith effort, you know, might be a six-figure engagement against an eight-figure fine potential. And, you know, not just the question of, is this company going to be charged? Is it going to get a DPA? Is it going to get an NPA? Is it going to get a straight declination?
Is it going to get a monitor?
Is it going to get a monitor? Is it going to spend X on a monitor? Is the person that you are saying to, hey, we're going to get sued, but we're going to take care of this. So we're going to spend the money. Someone who has discretion to say this should be a $100 million fine, an $80 million fine, or a $120 million fine, just to use that, I think it was the SAP example on the criminal side. I'm sure there's an expression that would cover that, but I won't try to pick a corny one. But it's short money to seek this kind of clawback or to expose oneself to this kind of civil litigation.
Yeah, absolutely. But wouldn't you rather be in the position where you can hold it back, and you don't have to go out trying to claw it back. You don't have to deal with it. Seems like. It's just another example of the planning being the advanced action being hugely valuable here. Just thinking about the language and putting yourself in the best possible position.
We've touched on a number of suggestions during the course of the last 45, 50 minutes to how companies can incentivize compliance to kind of position itself as best as possible under Part 5 versus Part 7, as Seth was saying. But maybe we could take 2 minutes and go around and just see if anyone has any other ideas to offer. And I also wanted just to remind everyone that the Q&A is open. And so we invite all of your questions. Jasmine, do you have any ideas you want to start with? Suggestions?
Yeah, so I was thinking about any perks or benefits associated with earning compliance rewards, you could say, that you could maybe transfer into money or some type of compensation, and also kind of company-wide visibility or department-wide visibility, right, of compliant behavior. So things that are both compensation-driven, but then also visibility-driven, so that it's known that this department, this company, is really taking compliance seriously. So those are a few things I was thinking about: perks and benefits, and then visibility throughout the company for compliant behavior.
Wells, anything to add?
So, like I said, I don't see in the actual documents, right? Like in the plans, in the employment agreements, the grant agreements, we don't see too much focus on this. But in the wider company culture, I've been involved in a few situations where we've been thinking about, had clients approach me and say things like, we have this program where we recognize, and I guess this actually ties to what Jasmine just said, we have these programs where we recognize employees for engaging in behaviors that benefit the business kind of at a more macro level. And it's more like programs like I see at my kids' school, like, a star for, a teacher catches you being kind, that kind of thing. We have a program here at Aiken where, if you bill a certain numbers of pro bono hours, that you get kind of graduating stars. And I've had clients approach me with those programs saying, hey, we'd like to link some compensation to these recognition programs. And I've worked with them on that. That strikes me as something that I think could be very effective. You've already got the kind of, people who do respond well to recognition, to being called out, having the chair of the board send an email saying, hey, here's the list of 6 individuals who've been identified for really pushing compliance at the organization. Here's exactly what they did, demonstrating, providing examples for other people to follow. I think something like that could be really effective.
And it's not just about outing the rat, right?
People
want necessarily to be known as the whistleblower internally. So you have to think about that, but there are lots of ways that people can support compliance in a very positive way that other people could get behind. One thing that comes to mind is walking away from business opportunities because of a compliance risk. That does happen, and it should be acknowledged and rewarded instead of, on the one extreme, you could have a company that just says, you're not hitting your numbers. Whereas another company, you get some award from the board actually for doing the right thing. Those are two very different cultures.
Having a carrot in your incentive program that says, hey, if you get recognized for this sort of thing, or if you behave in these sort of, if you follow these behaviors, you get an additional bump in your annual bonus, for example. Coupling that with the stick, that carrot with the stick of, and if you don't, we can take your money away. I think, you know, that'll I think that would be much more effective at promoting the behaviors we're looking for.
I have one other suggestion, and I'll turn it over to Seth. But I love the idea of really not just holding people accountable when they make mistakes and do things wrong, but holding people accountable and publicizing the things that they do right. In addition, I would say make it really stupid easy for people to do the right thing and to seek out help. I have one client who did something that I thought was just so easy and clever at the same time. And so I've been telling all other clients to do it. They issue company phones. Before they issue the phone, they pre-program the hotline number into it. So it's like literally there in the person's contact. Hard to argue later. You didn't know how to, you know, how to get in touch with the hotline. Seth, do you have any other last suggestions? And then I see we have a question to respond to.
So your mention of the board had me thinking about where compliance sits within the organization, and an organization can send an important message about the value it places on compliance by where that executive sits. Are they reporting to the board? Are they within the legal organization? Are they reporting to the CEO? How many dotted lines do you have to follow to get to compliance? And if you have to follow too many dotted lines, it probably doesn't look as good on the chart that you're presenting to the government when you're at your Section 5 stage. And then the other one that comes to mind is just exit interviews are a incredible source of the temperature, the compliance temperature in an organization. And so if you are, if you have a situation in which that information is not rolling up and compliance questions are not being asked there. We had an interesting case a while back where the exit interview was done by one co-conspirator of another who quit. So co-conspirator one says, I've had it, I'm out, and leaves the company, except the exit interview was done by someone who was in on it. And so that compliance moment missed its opportunity. So from the very top to the very retail, there are plenty of chances to show that compliance matters.
All right, so we've got a question for attorneys representing founders of startups and inventors. What's the best way to protect and advise them to direct their governance for positive outcomes? Any takers on our panel?
My very initial reaction is startups and your founders have small and lean organizations and can dictate tone and culture much more easily than an organization with 75,000 employees. So they're, you know, they're at the founding, they're communicating the values of the organization at a time when they can be created. They don't need to be changed. So I think it's a terrific space to be. If I were advising someone on this, you don't have to change the compensation system to what Wells is describing. You have it from the start and say, this is an organization that does business in this way. And so if you're a CEO and something bad happens on your watch, sorry, that's how it is here.
And when, you know, further down the line, as you're hiring more employees, I can tell you that a line that I often use that's very effective when negotiating with new folks who are starting, when they're pushing back on something in an employment agreement or they're asking for something bespoke, is to point out that the founder and CEO doesn't have that, or the founder and the CEOs are already agreed to that. And so having in the founder's agreement or the early employees agreement, having thought this through and baking in some of the holdback language and the clawback language, or, you know, just thinking it through and making sure that you like your definition of cause, that will pay benefits for the next 15 years as you're bringing on new employees, you're negotiating new agreements. So particularly valuable at the outset.
I like to analogize it to saving for retirement, talk dollars and cents to these founders. You know, you hear that if you start saving for retirement at, you know, age 24 versus at age 30, You know, the amount of money you'll have in your 401k is like triple by the age of retirement. I think the same way about compliance. Like, you start early and it will grow with the company at an accelerated pace in a positive way. If you try to do it later, you'll try to catch up, but it'll be harder. I don't want to say you'll never catch up, but it'll be much more costly, and it's harder to change cultures. But if you just invest a small amount at the beginning, you'll actually save a lot of money in the long run, a lot of money, not just legal fees, expert fees, e-discovery fees, fines and penalties, monitor fees. It's endless. So spend the money today. It's worth it, would be my pitch. All right. Any last words? I see we are just about approaching the half hour or the hour.
I think I need to go address my retirement savings issues.
Frightening. All right. With that, I think we'll just thank everyone for participating. We appreciate it. Have a good rest of the afternoon.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.